With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You can't win anything with kids.
I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
How much are the players looking forward to Arsene Wenger arriving?
Hi guys, and welcome to this week's episode of the Phoenix Five. We're lucky enough to be joined by a QPR, also playing for his time at Brentford, with Spurs, Sheffield Wednesday. We've got Mr. Andy Sinton. Andy, hello, how are you?
I'm very good, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. And I'm also joined today by David Holland.
So how are we doing, everyone? How are you doing, Andy? Nice to see you.
Hi, David, how are you?
So I'm going to jump straight in. I'm going to start your debut for Cambridge at 16. Young age to start going into pro football at 16. How was you treated?
How did it start? Well, there was no academies in those days. So I used to go during the school holidays. I would go local team, Newcastle family were huge Newcastle fans. My dad, God bless him, would have loved me to sign for Newcastle, I'm sure. But I had the chance and turned it down. I went to Arsenal. I went to Tottenham. Ipswich had just won the UEFA Cup in those days. Villa had just won the European Cup. I was playing for England schoolboys at the time, and I saw a lot of the kids I was playing with at the big clubs. And I made a conscious decision as a 15-year-old, I'm very stubborn, still am. I'm going to start at the bottom, if you like, and work my way up. So I chose Little Cambridge United. People thought I was mad. People laughed at me, said, yeah, what are you going there for? But I said to people, you know, I'm gonna go, I'm gonna start at the bottom, I'm gonna wrap the games up, and I'm gonna work my way up the pyramid. And you know, it worked out that way. It could have gone horribly wrong, but so that's how I ended up at Cambridge. As I say, my family, my dad was a huge Newcastle fan, I was a huge Newcastle fan. I saw a lot of kids in Newcastle go there and just end up playing on the parks on a Sunday, and I just thought, you know what, that's not for me. So that's how I went to Cambridge.
Did you write to clubs for trials? Because we've spoken to a few other guests like Rule Fox and a couple of others, and they used to write to clubs to get trials. Did you do the same thing?
No, never wrote any club. I used to go to, you know, I was playing for the school team, I was playing for the district, I was playing for the county. Eventually went on to get selected for England schoolboys. So there was a lot of interest in me, and I just used to, it was in the school holidays, a local scout would come around the house and say, can you come down in the May half term, or the Easter holidays, or the February half term? And so it was just a case of going where you saw fit during the school holidays, technically on trial, really. Trained by Newcastle twice a week. But I'd made my mind up as a 15-year-old, I wasn't going to join a big club. I remember getting on a train as a 15-year-old to go to Tottenham and Arsenal, and it seems quite strange for someone who spent the majority of his career in London. I said, I'll never go to London, it's too big. You know, this massive city seemed to be vast and everything. So So, yeah, I turned quite a few big clubs. I did turn quite a few big clubs down and signed for Little Cambridge United and loved every minute of it. No regrets.
So after Cambridge, you moved to Brentford, where you played close to 150 games, and you caught the eye of Jerry Francis at QPR, who signed you for £350,000. What was your time like at QPR?
You know, I love my time at QPR. Well, first of all, I love my time at Brentford as well. I've got a lot to thank Brentford for. You know, they picked me up, or John Doherty picked me up when I was going nowhere at Cambridge. My career was, you know, started really well first couple of years. I think I won Cambridge Player of the Year when I was 18. But the next year we really struggled, got relegated. And I, like the team, was nosediving. And if it wasn't for John Doherty, who had gone to Brentford, who signed me, I think, for £30,000, who knows where my career would have gone. I would end up probably back in Newcastle. So, you know, I say a lot of kids sometimes it's about a lucky break or someone who just believes in you. Well, John Doherty believed in me, took me to Brentford with Frank McClintock, had four brilliant years there, loved it there, caught the interest of many clubs, and used to read and hear certain teams were interested in you, but QPR were the ones who put their money where their mouth was and bought me. And, you know, it was QPR for me, the 4.5 years, I played for some brilliant clubs. I played with some brilliant players, brilliant managers. But my 4.5 years at Rangers was the happiest of my career. It's a special club for me. But that's where I had my best time. And if you think I went from Brentford third division to playing for England within 20 months or something, 2 years, it's quite a remarkable sort of rise. But
you made your debut. I'm a Man United supporter, and you made your debut against Man United in the 4-1 win. And your first goal was obviously against United at Old Trafford. And then you scored a hat-trick against Everton later on in the season. I think it was the same season. You was on fire at QPR in that opening season. It was, as a left winger, you was unstoppable, and especially the Old Trafford game. I watched the highlights of it yesterday. And you was, it was... You smashed our left back all over the place. Club at QPR, what was the dressing room like?
Nah, brilliant dressing room. You know, the season that you're referring to there was, you know, that you had the likes of, well, you know, good friend of mine, sadly no longer with us, Ray Wilkins, was an exceptional player, but an even better, in fact, I can't find a word to describe as a person, as a human being. And, you know, the things he taught me, not just on the pitch, you know, but around the plate, you know, how to act, how to conduct yourself, how to speak, how to make people feel good about themselves, have time for everyone. I just hope some of his traits have rubbed off on me. He was absolutely brilliant in the restroom. Les Ferdinand was, you know, on fire for a few seasons, probably a little bit biased, but probably for two or three seasons, the best, if not the best, but on a par with the best centre forward in the country for those two or three years. At the back, we had Alan McDonald, QPR legend, brilliant lad, great player. Dave Bardsley, great player. Clyde Wilson, great player. Andy Impey, super player. You know, we had the early 90s, 92, 93, we had a brilliant side without realising. No egos. No big time Charlies. Harry Francis wouldn't allow that. Ray Wilkins wouldn't allow that. And we played at the time where I think we just used to just play. I know we were getting paid and probably getting paid quite well, but we just played for fun. We really enjoyed our time. Used to love playing at Loftus Road, and nothing better at Loftus Road when one of the big boys comes to town and you look around the dressing room, you go, you know what? Fancy our chances today. Because we've got Ferdinand, we got Wilkins, we got McDonald, we've got a good goalkeeper in Stachel or Tony Roberts. You know, special times for me, QPR, really were.
So you win at home, Loftus Road on a Saturday, 3 o'clock kickoff, you're done by 5:30. Where are you going on the night out afterwards? Springboks, the White Horse, Pavilion? where's the QPR players' haunts?
No. Well, I don't know, you know, because most of the lads lived, and I've always done it throughout my career. Wherever I've played, I've lived about 40 minutes away. I used to like to get in the car, digest the game on the way home, good or bad. And by the time you're home, you've got a little bit of family time. I don't believe you take the game home with you as a player. It stays with you. If you've had a shocker individually or if the team have lost heavily, it spoils your whole weekend. But vice versa, if you played really well, you're on a bit of a high, but, you know, you go home and you've got to put the kids to bed. You know, that's a little bit of a come down, but a nice come down. So my Saturday nights were either out for a meal with some friends or just a quiet night in with my wife looking after the kids, basically. And that's the way I preferred it. I wasn't a clubber. I wasn't a limelight guy. I just used to play the game, do well, do not so well, get home and get ready for the Monday morning, basically. Quite boring.
Yeah, you played 12 games for England. Were you disappointed not to make more appearances? I mean, you should be proud of the 12 that you made, but... Do you think you deserve more?
That was. I hate the word deserve because I think you get what you get. Here, football teams are saying we deserve to win today. Well, you know, we say it sometimes at QPR. You know, so if you had said to me as a 16-year-old kid the day I left home, Newcastle, to go to Cambridge, you know what, in 6 or 7 years' time, you're gonna have 12 England caps. I would have paid money for it. So I class myself as a very lucky man, you know, so proud, very patriotic. To play for your country is, I get asked it a lot. I get asked it by kids when I do talks and stuff like that. You know, what's it like? It's a dream come true. I remember playing in the field in Newcastle as a 9, 10-year-old, and you got these sort of dreams in your head, and you commentate, and you're banging the ball against your fence, and you're annoying the neighbours, and they come and say, oh, you pack it in sort of thing, you know, but... You put yourself playing for England, and so it's a dream come true, and mine came true. You know, was I the best player? Had a really good career. I worked my socks off to get everything I got. Should I got more caps? I don't know. Other people be the judge of that. Some people probably think I didn't deserve any caps, but you know, though, again, that doesn't bother me. It is what it is. I've got 12 caps. Played in about 6 positions for my country, which
you didn't know.
I'm very proud of that, actually. People say, you know what, you know, you've gone to a major tournament with your country, even though it didn't go particularly well for the group. So now just, and you know what, I always felt I was John Barnes as understudy, as a left winger. John Barnes, when he was at Liverpool, was phenomenal. So for me to be John's, I had to wait for him to get injured to play sort of things, unless Graham Taylor played me in certain positions, which he did, you know. So now just a very, very proud. Got the England debut shirt behind me. We've got the caps in my study downstairs. Got my memories, and that, you know what, that's all I need. I don't need people to tell me how good I was or how bad I was. I'm not really interested, you know. I've got my memories, and that's all I need. So very, very, just say very privileged and very proud man to represent your country, really.
Do you think the QPR players at the time were overlooked? Because there was obviously yourself, Ferdinand, Bardsley, Wilson, as you said. Do you think there was not a bias, because that's probably not the right word, but there were favourites maybe, and no matter how well you played on a Saturday, you struggled to get in at being at QPR, because Ferdinand moved on and then was an England regular. But everyone else who stayed at QPR at that period struggled. Do you think there was a bit of bias there or not?
I'm not sure if it was bias, but as I say, I think QPR was seen as certainly one of the big clubs, even though we used to beat them. You know, the 92-93 QPR, we were top London club. Beat Tottenham, beat Arsenal, beat Chelsea, finished above them, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it was a little bit of a breakthrough when I got in the team. I was the first one out of that batch. Then Les got in the team, quite rightly. Dave Bardsley, brilliant, brilliant right back, fit as a fiddle, up and down, probably a modern day fullback as we see now, could cross for fun. Clyde Wilson was probably, in my opinion, probably the unluckiest player not to play for England. Clyde, for 2 years at QPR, he was phenomenal. Really, really was. But if you look at the England team at the time, you had Stuart Pearce. You had Tony DiRigo, you had Julian Dix. All of those were playing really well for so-called bigger clubs. So that probably held Clive back to a degree. But I wouldn't say there was a bias, but as I say, I think one or two of our players Simon Barker was playing well. I think he was on the verge of getting in the squad at one stage. So now we, you know, never really thought about it that much. I was just happy to get the call myself. Delighted when Les and Dave got in. Delighted for my club. You know, when I went to play for England, I felt I was representing my club. I felt I was representing our fans. Not just representing myself and my family. I felt, you know, this is almost an honour for our club as well. So, and you know what? If you flip QPR back to the 75 team, what a team then when you had five or six England internationals. You had the captain of the England team, Gerry Francis. You know, so QPR have had it. But yeah, the 92-93 team was a special team for me.
I've got a question from one of our listeners, Ben Eckford. He says, what was the England camp like at Euro 92? Who did you room with? And what was the atmosphere in the squad like?
Euro 92, obviously you represent your country, you get to a major tournament, albeit in those days it was like a two-week tournament. There was eight teams. It wasn't like anything like we get now where there's six or seven groups or eight groups and this, that, and the other. You know, it was basically we played Denmark, France, and Sweden, the hosts. Mood in the camp was good prior to going. I got in at the last minute through John's injury. That's well documented. First game, I remember, we played Denmark, drew 0-0, and probably got a little bit of criticism. 2 weeks later, Denmark went on to win it. We then played what was seen as the top two in the group, the two favourites, England, France, and we played at a 0-0 draw. And suddenly we're you're thinking, okay, we've now got to play the hosts in the backyard and we've got to beat Sweden to qualify. And doesn't matter how good the opposition is, when you play the hosts in the home country, that's going to be a tough game. So I think we went 1-0 up. I think Platty scored, David Platt. But they pegged us back and we got beat 2-1 and didn't qualify, weren't in the top two. So we were getting a plane home. So it was an optimistic group going into the tournament. But that night and when we got beat against Sweden, it's probably goes without saying, it's one of the lowest points of my career because you sit there, you're on a bus, you're going back to the hotel, you know you're going back home tomorrow, and you think, you know what? Think we've let the country down here. That sort of goes through your mind, you know, and you know criticism's coming because of the nature of the beast. You know the manager's going to get criticized, you know the players are going to get criticized, and quite rightly so. So the mood in the camp was, you know, full of hope. I didn't think anyone thought we could win it, but you know when there's only eight teams in it, you've got a great chance. Denmark won it, you know, they got in the back door through political reasons, et cetera, et cetera. So it was just a big, big disappointment not to qualify for the semi-finals. And for the Euros, is probably the first time where Graham Taylor started to give us our own rooms, which I quite like because I've shared a room with a couple of people who like the telly on till 1 o'clock in the morning. They like to be on the phone. They like to get up at 7 in the morning, have a shower. I wanted to lie in. So I think it's quite difficult when you room with someone. So in the Euros, we actually had a room each, which, you know, you do your training, you go back for your lunch, you have a couple hours rest in the afternoon. There was something, analysis or watch something related to the opposition. But there's a lot of time to kill when you're at a tournament and away on international duty. And I see in later times, they used to set up, you know, games rooms, table tennis, pool, except we didn't have any of that. So it was a case of, you know, just chatting with teammates and getting off the bed. And yeah, that was the hardest part about being away for a 2-3 week period, was the time you had between training and the next game to really occupy yourself. Because you're shut away, you don't see anyone, you can't go anywhere.
7-1 game, England San Marino. You played in it. England had to win by 7 clear goals to qualify. Now, tell me what the dressing room was like that after. Because, I mean, to win 7-1 and still be so disappointed is unbelievable.
We knew we had to score a lot of goals and we were confident we'd score goals. I think there was there was another game going on somewhere. I think something to do with Holland. I think they were winning, which was coming through. But what I remember most about the San Marino game was the first 10 seconds of the game.
Yeah.
You know, San Marino scored in about, I think it was 10 seconds. So, you know, I think Stewart made a mistake, which even the best players in the world do. But, you know, we went on. I think Wrighty scored four. But we knew when we come in the dressing room, we knew it wasn't enough. And again, mentioned Euro 92, getting beat from Sweden, knowing that you hadn't qualified for a World Cup tournament was a huge blow. Not only to myself, but a lot of the players. You know, that's a, you dream of playing for your country. You dream of playing in huge tournaments because what that can bring on the big stage. But again, you know, did we deserve it? We obviously not, because we didn't get there. So, you know, you got to be philosophical. Hurt like hell. You know, that was the one chance I had, and it was taken away. Never got another opportunity. So, but you know, no regrets. Did our best. Weren't good enough over not just that game, over the 2 year period. You know, games at home, we were 2-0 up against Holland. Got pegged back to 2-2. 1-1 at home to Norway when we were winning with 10 minutes to go. People look at the San Marino game, but you know, there was games in that group where we actually threw it away.
That's a mentality thing, would you say? Or is it a managerial issue?
I would probably, you know, being a manager, I think, you know, once you're on the pitch, I think it comes down to the players. And if you're 2-0 up against Holland, who are arguably the best team in the group, you just have to find a way. I think we gave a penalty away on the stroke of half-time, let them back into the game, and they scored late on, I think, against Norway. I think we definitely, as a group, as a team, we were 1-0 up, and I wouldn't say try to protect that, but we didn't really go for the juggler, and we paid the price because I think a midfield player for Norway rifled the volley in from about 25 yards into the top corner at Wembley. You're just going, wow, where did there was probably their only shot all night, but you know, that's what it was. So no, I don't think it was a mentality. I think, you know, a little bit of fear comes in on the pitch, you know, playing for your country, the expectation from everywhere, fans, media, etc. Maybe that got you. Now, you should be able to deal with that.
You mentioned the media there. And that's in the podcast we've done, we spoke about the media and England, because we spoke about the Euro 96 squad, and we touched on the golden generation, so-called. I know Holland doesn't like it to be called that, but that's what it was labelled in the press. Did you sense the pressure from the media? Did you feel, you know, that there was a constant negative around the British media in towards England and players in England, and the headlines and sensationalism? You know, did you read the papers as England players? I know people say, oh, you know, we try and knock it out, but it must be very difficult.
Did I read the papers? Not really. But someone will always tell you what's in them, so in effect you read them, because there's no escape. Did I sense? I just felt, because we're England, there was, you know, we were built up, major tournaments. You see what happens now. You know, major tournament, the country galvanizes behind everybody. There's this expectation, if you like. I think it's only the last few years where the expectation's been dampened a little bit, and we've actually done quite a lot better. But you know, that's where we are, and you have to deal with it. And if you can't, you sink or you swim. And you know, media have got a job to do. On the whole, I think the majority of the media are brilliant, really, really good. I think they're fair. Used to get the odd one or two would just look for a little angle to come at. But as I say, I've certainly, during my career, I've had no problems at all with good or bad. I think you earn that on the pitch. You know, results will dictate that. Performances will dictate that. And you just have to get on with it.
So you decide to move from QPR. Was that a club call or your decision?
When I left QPR, yeah. It's been well documented. I get asked a lot. I got a lot of stick for leaving. People thought it was my instigation. It wasn't. I've said it a million times, and I'll say it one more time. QPR were a club in the 90s, late 80s, who every year they sold a player. In my time, it was David Seaman. Next year, it was Paul Parker. Next year, it was Roy Wegley. Then it was me, year after, or a couple of years later, Darren Peacock. Then it was Les. Then it was Sinclair. So it was that, you know what? That was QPR's model. You bought from a smaller club, i.e., Darren Peacock came from Hereford. Les came from non-league. I came from Brentford. They used to polish you up and sell you profit. Nothing wrong with that. But where I got annoyed at the time was I was perceived to be saying I was in the England team. QPR were top London club. We finished fifth in the Premier League. I had just moved house to Ascot. I just had a small baby. But I was perceived as the one that wanted to go. I wanted to go at the end when QPR refused to give me a new deal or refused to up my deal. Which when you're playing for England, you know your value. It's like anyone. If you're good at your job and you're getting underpaid for what you're delivering, you just want a little bit of parity with your peers sort of thing, you know. But so a little bit of both. Sad to leave. QPR, as I said, we had just finished top London club. With a couple of additions, possibly could have pushed on. But I went up to Sheffield Wednesday. No problems there. Signed for Trevor Francis again, who had signed me at Rangers. Every time you move, a new chapter. No guarantees. Your new chapter comes and you see what it brings you.
You signed for Sheffield Wednesday for a club record fee at a time of 2.75 million. Did that add extra pressure?
You know what? I would say no. But I think it did, because I think I slightly changed to try and justify the fee. I think it was one of the, in the top 10 of the English transfer fees at the time. I had no reason to change, but I think psychologically something inside me thought I might have to do a little bit more. Whereas, you know what, that was what they paid for me. That was what you were getting. You're buying what you've seen. So really, but that was, you know what, I would even go so far as to say maybe that was a weakness on my behalf, rather than just playing my natural game, maybe try to change a little bit. You know, my time at Sheffield Wednesday started really well. Picked up a couple of injuries. You know, I went 5 years at QPR, missed one game. I broke my foot at Sheffield Wednesday and I played with her for a few weeks. I say broke my foot, it was a hairline crack. And all the people that I went to see, they couldn't detect it. So I was playing in a bit of pain. I was playing with painkillers. My form started to dip, and eventually it showed that I had this heel. I had put my foot in a cast, blah, blah, blah. And to be fair, I never really, if I'm being brutally honest, I never really picked my best form up at Sheffield Wednesday from that moment on. Couldn't string four or five games together. Big club, great fans. But for me, probably if I look back at my career, it's probably the only time where I would say, you know what, didn't quite do as well as I would have wanted at that club.
But did Arsenal make a move for you when you left QPR? Is that correct?
No, it was Arsenal were in for me at the time of QPR. It was Arsenal or Sheffield Wednesday. And I think Liverpool and the Sui Grain Souness were in as well. But it was the choice I had. Well, it wasn't a choice. It was Arsenal or QPR. Sheffield Wednesday when I was at QPR. Arsenal put their bid in. QPR, again, allowed me to speak. They rang me up and said, you know, we've had a bid from Arsenal. We've accepted it. So go and talk to them. Spoke to George Graham on the Friday. I knew Sheffield Wednesday were in at the same amount, but for some reason, I hadn't been given permission to speak to Sheffield Wednesday, which I found a little bit baffling. I said it way back in the interview when I was 15, I'm very stubborn. And the stubbornness came here because I knew Sheffield Wednesday were offering the same amount of money in terms of a transfer fee. So I said to George Graham, totally upfront with George, like, you know, Arsenal were going places. George, brilliant manager who I played for later in my career and loved playing for him at Tottenham. I said to George, you know what, like what you've said, George, but if we're talking about the next 4 years of my life, my career, there's another team I know are at the same level. I want to speak to the other team. George was brilliant. George said, fine. He said, fully respect that, fully accept that. He said, have the weekend to speak to the other club. And we'll see where we are. And but he didn't say, I'm giving you till Monday, but that's basically where he was coming from. He said, have the weekend and see where you are Monday. I still wasn't given permission to speak to Sheffield Wednesday until that Monday. Monday came, Arsenal called and said, deal's off. And I thought it was a bit of brinkmanship from George to say, right, you know what, you've had 4 days, you still haven't given us a yes or a no, so you know what, forget it. Strangely enough, as soon as that call I got, an hour late, I was allowed to speak to Sheffield Wednesday. spoke to Sheffield Wednesday, liked what I heard from Trevor. I felt, you know, their team at the time, David Hurst, top-class striker, Chris Waddle, wonderful player, John Sheridan, wonderful player, you know, Roland Nielsen, Nigel Pearson, Des Walker, Nigel Worthington, you know, the list goes on. Carlton was playing for England at the time and very underrated for what he did. Mark Bright, you know, so I felt, you know, this Roland Nielsen, great right back, I think I've already said, Chris Woods, the goalkeeper, England international. I felt this was a team on the up. So so because of what happened at Arsenal, I went to speak to Sheffield and decided to go to Sheffield. And don't regret it one bit. Loved my time there. Just as I said, didn't quite work out as well as I wanted, and certainly as well as maybe the Sheffield Wednesday fans wanted and expected, you know, but it happens.
You mentioned David Hurst there. One of the pods is one of our favourite. Percy, and there's another member who's not here today, David Graham, have both said he was in our underrated 11, like one of the most underrated players to play in football in that era. And Ferguson went in for him famously 3 times and could never quite get the transfer over the line. How good was he? Because obviously you've been with Ferdinand as well and players at Tottenham. Would you say he was the most complete striker that you played with?
It's hard to say the most complete, because if you look at Ferdinand, Shearer, Lineker, Wright, Sheringham, you know, but I put Hursty in that bracket, because David, at the time I went to Sheffield Wednesday, and bearing in mind I didn't play with him that much because he had his injury, but, you know, Hursty was quick, he was powerful, he could score all sorts of goals, you know, outside the box, inside the, with his head, you know, he's a great lad as well, great lad. Now, David was a phenomenal striker, and, you know, that's what I talked about in your career, you know, you need that little bit of luck, or you need someone to believe in you. You know, if Hursty hadn't snapped his Achilles tendon, who knows what he would have achieved? Who knows? Because the lad was a phenomenal striker. He had the lot, you know, quick. He could run away from defenders. He could play with his back to goal. You know, he could outpace people and strike things from 20 yards. Brilliant striker. But again, a little bit of bad luck. Dents your career, and he was probably never, I don't know what David thinks of this, you know, played golf with him a couple of years ago and we had a good laugh and a chat about our times and stuff. Probably after the injury, he was never quite at the level that he was prior to that. And that is a real, real shame, because brilliant striker, really top draw striker.
Oh, brilliant. So QPR, you had 3 managers at your time at QPR, Jerry Francis, Trevor Francis and Don Howe. How was it under their 3 management? I mean, did you find anyone particularly more favourable you like to work with, tactically better? What was that like? Because 3 managers in quite a short period of time, quite unsettling.
No, as I say, Trevor signed me, you know, grateful for Trevor. You know, signed me a couple of times, but, you know, he was the one that took me from third division to the big time, if you like. Really enjoyed my time under Trevor. Trevor was still playing at the time, you know, player manager. You know, I remember he scored a hat-trick at Villa, and being an ex-Birmingham player, you can imagine what that was like. And he had scored 3 and he was unplayable that day. Took himself off with 2 minutes to go when he was furthest away from the dugout so he can make the slow walk across the pitch. You know, things didn't go... Things started to turn for Trevor in the club. Don Howe, who Trevor had brought in as his sidekick, took over. Don was a brilliant coach. Don, I really enjoyed Don. Taught me a lot about my game. There was this perception of Don that he was quite cagey and negative. And not what we saw. You know, we did one day a week, which most teams do, where they'll work on the defensive side of the game with their team. The rest of the time was all about, you know, playing to our strengths. Probably the first coach that really encouraged players to get me on the ball. That coincided with Ray Wilkins coming to the club. You know, Ray used to give me the ball in areas where probably other players hadn't given it. And he used to say, you're good enough, you know, playing tight areas and, you know, build your confidence up. Don was really, really good. Then Jerry came in. And if you said to me throughout my career, who's the manager that's had the biggest influence on your career? Yeah, it was Jerry Francis at QPR. Jerry, I met him the first day, sat in his office, and I still remember it. He said, you know what? He said, I believe in you, and I think you can play for your country. I think you can play for England. And I sort of laughed out of embarrassment a little bit. Yeah, okay. As if he was just saying that as a motivational pep talk or whatever. You know, seriously, he said, you've got things to work on your game, but he said, I'm going to help you, and you're going to play for England. And, you know, within a year. But Jerry used to give you that freedom on the pitch. That wine, if I wasn't getting the ball, he would give me. I used to take it on myself a little bit, not at the detriment of the team. I used to take it on myself to go and take up a false position, maybe infield or behind the front two. And Jerry used to encourage that. As long as it didn't affect the team when we lost the ball, he'd say, go on, get on the ball, go and be creative. And he gave me that confidence and freedom. And you know what? When someone who's captain the country on the first day meets you, says, you know what, you're going to play for your country. That, I think from day one, he gave me the confidence to go and play. And I know it wasn't just me. I think he had a similar conversation with Les. Jerry was brilliant. His training was hard. You know, Terror Tuesday, we never used to see a ball on the Tuesday. We didn't have a midweek game, didn't see a ball. We knew it was coming, but in a strange sort of way, I speak for myself, but I know I speak for some of my teammates who are still seeing now and again. We used to enjoy the running because it was so hard, but it used to galvanize on us. And I'm sure that togetherness, that team spirit, where you're pulling each other when really you just want to stop, but you just got to keep going for the last 10 seconds of a run or something. You know, I think that won us points. And what Jerry did at QPR, created a brilliant dressing room, a great togetherness. Used to love playing in front of the fans at Loftus Road. You know, I played at some wonderful stadiums. But there's nowhere better when your team, you're playing with QPR, you're playing at home, under the lights, that stadium is full and the crowd are with you. It feels like there's 40,000 there. I remember beating Arsenal one year in the cup, beat them 2-0 a replay. Kenny Sansom scored the first. Peed down a rain all night. Wonderful game of football. I got the second in injury time. But that stadium, I think they said there was 22,000. I felt that was about 40,000. It was rocking. And, you know, but going back to Jerry, great man manager, great tactician. He took me to Tottenham as well. A lot to thank Jerry Francis for. To be fair, as I have every manager, I've taken something from every manager that I've played. Well, probably took the most from Jerry.
Just a fan question, because obviously you moved on to Wolverhampton. So one of the questions from, David Williams. Memories of playing at Wolves, and they said he played some great football towards the end of his career. Any memories that you'd like to talk about?
Well, thanks, David, for that kind comment. You know, again, sounds like a broken record. You know, had a super career. I love my time at Wolves. 3 seasons out at Wolves, in a massive club, steeped in tradition. I went under Colin Lay. We were in the trying to get to the Premiership. We just missed out. But, you know, Molineux, again, wonderful stadium. Any memories, you know, for Wolves fans, you know, when you're playing West Brom and you beat them, always stays in their memory, stays in mine. I remember we beat West Brom 3-1. Lots of happy memories and enjoyed my time there.
Best locker room prank or you played or was played on yourself?
Mr. Gascoigne used to have a few.
Gascoigne comes up in every interview we have.
Just really childish, stupid ones. You know, Graeme Taylor, the manager, used to be a big Buddy Holly fan. So during the England time, the weekend before we were due to play, Graeme sometimes used to be organised go-kart or a theatre trip or something. And so one night we all tootled off on the England coach into London to the Buddy Holly story at the theatre. And you've got Gazza in there, you know. He's just so childish. While he goes really quiet, he's sitting in the back row, or not in the back row, but he's sitting in his seat. He's got all his sweet papers and he's rustling them. And you've got everyone who's sort of, so it's making quite a noise. Sounds really childish. And you've got people turning around going, shh. So it goes quiet again. Then he'll get his sweet papers and rustle them. And so it's making a, just stupid little things, you know. You know, at QPR, Alan MacDonald and Dave Bardsley used to put your clothes up on hangers if they thought you were wearing a little bit of a dodgy shirt or something. The old one that many clubs and many guys have been on, you know, your socks cut or your shoes nailed to the floor, bags hidden at the airport terminal, you know, where you're waiting for your bag and someone's took it off the carousel and put it behind the pillar where you can't see it and you're there for, you're keeping the coach waiting. So just stupid little things, too many to list. And
yeah, I've just got one more question for you, Andy. Obviously, you played for a few clubs. Your favourite local derby, like, was it your Steel derby or your North London derby? What was the one that got you up for it the most?
Well, you know, at the time of QPR, we used to, you know, I've said before, we used to beat the likes of Chelsea most times when they come to us. I know there's this huge rivalry. Never played against Brentford for either club, so I couldn't say that one at QPR. Tottenham Arsenal was fierce, could be horrible. Sheffield derby was fierce, could be horrible. Wolves West Brom was not one for the faint hearted. So, you know, I think any derby, I think for me, I wouldn't like to say which one was the I used to love them. You know, bring them on. Wolves were playing at West Brom. Go on, bring it on. Even if we're away, come on, bring it on. You know you're going to get dogs abuse, but go on, let's have it. Arsenal the same. You know, you go there. Sheffield, you know, I think derbies are for the fans. As a player, you know the importance of it. And you know the importance of it because it's rammed down your throat 2 weeks before. You know, if you can't get beat against these, don't care if you lose your next four, but you don't get beat against these. But I think the players who handle derbies the best are the ones who can know the importance of it, know what it means, certainly for the fans, but are able to get on the pitch and switch all of that noise, if you like, and just concentrate on being the best they can be and helping their team. But I've been involved in some great games, really, really have. And again, all in my memory bank, got some wonderful memories, and I'll treasure them till the day that I'm not here.
We can't have you on here and not mention the fact that you won the League Cup. You've still got your medal? You're going to show it to us now? It must be behind you where that England shirt is, surely.
No, it's that. I'm not actually in my study here. My daughter, because she's just done a dissertation, a final, taken over my study, if you like. So I brought this up because when I sit and blah, 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 I still look at it. Still got my medal, yep. Cup final, Tottenham, Leicester. Worst game in the world. I think we came out the tunnel to Robbie Williams singing "Let Me Entertain You." Well, we certainly didn't do that. It was the worst game in history, but I think, bless him, you know, I think Justin got sent off, Justin Embra. You know, what a tragedy that was just a couple of years ago to lose Justin. Wonderful lad, you know, 49, setting out on a really promising managerial career. And it just shows you, you know, take nothing for granted. So Justin got sent off, but Alan Nielsen scored a diving header. So we won with 10 men, 1-0. I got on for about the last 4 minutes of the game. I think once we scored, I think George put me on as I think he took David Ginola off and said, "Go on, Andy, just keep it nice and tight. We don't need David's flair anymore. Go and keep it nice and tight." But you know what? A lot of people, a lot of clubs, a lot of fans, I wouldn't say they disrespect the Carabao Cup or the Worthington Cup or whatever it's being called over there. But I tell you what, when you're at Wembley and you win and you're celebrating with your fans and you're making a fool of yourself on the pitch and you're having a few beers afterwards, there's no better feeling. Winning a trophy is...
Go about management. You went into management 5 years at Fleet Town. How was the transition from player to manager?
Bearing in mind, I went in non-league and I sort of stumbled across it, you know, a friend of mine was chairman of the club and he wanted me to go down. And, you know, I was coming to the end of my career and I just started with my badges, my coaching badges. And I didn't really fancy it. But anyway, cutting a long story short, was doing a little bit of business with Graham, my friend who was the chairman. And he enticed me down there in a player overseeing capacity. Then I eventually took the reins as a man. Loved it. You know, the non-league boys, how can I say this? You know, whatever they were playing for, 50, 70, 100 quid, they'd run through a brick wall for you. I've got so much time and respect for the non-league footballers, you know, because I've had plumbers, I've had carpet fitters who've been on their knees all day, you know, fitting builders coming off a building site. Then they come into the game or training, you're expecting them to perform and you've got your standards. And, you know, they were brilliant. I'd, you know, 5 years at Fleet. You know, what was it, step six or step seven, doesn't matter. I think we won, bearing in mind we did have a budget, bearing in mind we won 15 trophies, had a couple of good FA Cup runs. I loved it. I used to get a little bit frustrated at times, more so with off-the-field things, you know, things I would take for granted or things I've had throughout my career, you know, travel a certain distance and having a stop, well, and a bit of food for the players. Well, that wasn't even on the agenda. I found that a little bit strange. And I left, you know, I left Fleet. I went to Telford in the conference and, you know, got promoted in my first season. Brilliant set of guys again. You know, we were part-time playing in a, what was then, and certainly is now, a pretty much full-time league. But we were part-time. We trained on a Tuesday and a Thursday. And I used to find it frustrating because you'd have what you want to work on a Thursday night ready for your Saturday game. Let's say if I wanted to work on my back four, then I get three of my back four phoning at the last minute saying, my boss won't let me off work. Okay, tear the script up, just let's go and play. And now, you know what, the part-time footballers, I have so much respect for them. I really admire them, you know, for what they do, the time commitment that they put in for not a great deal of money. Certainly the level I was at wasn't a great deal of money, but they run through a brick wall for you. Love their football. All at different levels. You know, you had young kids who had been released from pro clubs with a dream of getting back. And, you know, I really took it on myself to try and help those because, you know, rejection for a youngster is horrible. We had guys at the end of their career who knew they weren't, that was the highest they were going to play at and were happy to go and be plumbers and this, that and the other, but would still show great professionalism, if that's the right word, even though they wasn't professionals, they weren't professionals. No, absolutely brilliant. Love my managerial time in the non-league setup. Went out of it, did a few bits and bobs, loved my coaching, got all my badges, coach kids, love to influence kids, going into schools, trying to motivate youngsters because there's potential in every kid. There's potential in everyone. It just needs someone somewhere to help them, to believe in them, to give them hope, to give them something to hang on to. So I really enjoy that side of things. Still do a little bit of that now. And obviously this role at QPR where my role goes right across the club other than coaching the players basically, but love my role at QPR. Absolutely love it. Love the engagement with the fans. We love the engagement with former players. I love to see us growing behind the scenes. And I think as a club, we're on our way back after a couple of, you know, hardish years, which we had to go through for some reason. Some great people at the club. And I say, I think we've had a good season. Let's see if we can build on that for next year. But, you know, in answer to your question, love managing, love coaching, love inspiring youngsters. If I do, well, I hope I do when I speak to them. And you know what? Just love life. And what we've gone through in the last year just brings it home to you. Just enjoy every day. Get the best out of yourself every day. Be the best you can be every day. And
a very positive interview, which was fantastic. It was nice to, you obviously love what you do. You love what you did. You know, you speak with a lot of passion, but a lot of positive passion. There's nothing negative, and even when things haven't worked out, you've owned up and said, well, maybe it didn't, which takes, you know, it's a lot of courage to come out and say maybe it was a weakness and things like that. So I'm just going to finish off with a quick fire round. Cristiano Ronaldo or Brazilian Ronaldo?
Oh, right. Cristiano.
Yes. Get in. Pie mash or fish and chips?
Fish and chips.
The best player you played with?
Paul Gascoigne.
Eric Cantona or Dennis Bergkamp?
Cantona.
Ketchup or brown sauce?
Brown.
90s football or noughties football?
90s.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Everyone, Andy Sinton, thank you so much for giving us your time. Really appreciate it.
Podcast Network. It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.